Well, good morning, everyone. And welcome to those who are here for the first time, and those who are returning after greater or lesser periods of time, and to those who have crossed the waters and the borders to get here, Onsen Colleen from Victoria, and Daikon John from Seattle, and Chikyo Yuen from Colorado via Seattle. How great that we are having a little more mobility than we have for the last couple of years, and we get to see good old friends from other sanghas who have, well, really had been connected to Mountain Rain for a long time. Apologies for the humidity in here this morning. Our thermostat is not functioning, so we don't have any fan or air. So we'll have a little ambient sound, but that's just fine. So not yesterday, but a week ago, Saturday, we had our one-day women's retreat out of Blue Mountain Zendo, which is where we live. And it was originally supposed to be a three-day retreat, residential, but that our venue wasn't quite ready up and running yet. So we didn't get to enjoy some of the stories of our women ancestors that we often do. We always close the retreat with a ceremony honoring our women ancestors, not only our Dharma and Zen ancestors, but our familial, cultural, chosen ancestors. You know, all those who supported our capacity to be right here now practicing together. Just think. You know, really, how many? And it's good exercise to do that, you know, if you maybe haven't felt supported by your familial ancestors in your life and practice, to connect to who, you know, people that you don't even know, you know, writers, artists, all those who have influenced you on your path. It's really good to stop and reflect on that once in a while. So we do that at the women's retreat. And so I, last week I decided I wanted to share some of those stories, and then I realized I couldn't fit them all in, and that I had chosen to arrange them in the order of a lifespan our path of development as human beings, right? So last week I talked about stories of our women Dharma and Zen ancestors, sort of from childhood, youth, and into kind of beginning adulthood, you know, forming relationships, kind of beginning to form identity. You know, we're supposed to let go of ourself in our Zen practice, right? But I think there is some truth to that saying, you know, you have to have a self to lose a self. I think you have to kind of have a functional self-structure in this world. What we learn in our practice is that self-structure is provisional, subject to change, and conditioned, so we can hold it more lightly and flexibly and openly. Right? You know, people think, oh, I have to, like, get rid of my ego, right? Banish my ego. Not really. We have to see into it, see it clearly. So I really kind of like this developmental perspective, so I want to continue it today. The other thing we looked at last week, for those of you who were here, if you weren't, it's posted on the website, how moving into adolescence and young adulthood, we lose often a kind of wholeness that we had, you know, when we were little kids. You know, sometimes that splitting starts pretty early, but it really comes into play, into force, when we're moving into our roles in society. You know, in school, there are those divisions of, you know, I don't know what they're called these days, the nerds and the stoners and the, all those, right? And the preppies. There's probably some new words I don't even know. And then we, you know, we want to be accepted. We want to be accepted by our peers. We want to please our parents. We want to please all of, you know, our workplace environment. And so we start splitting ourselves up and choosing, picking and choosing what we show where and to whom. And sometimes we actually forget parts of ourselves. So then part of moving through life and maturing is kind of how we expand that sphere of concern. You know, adolescence, early adulthood, very, very self-focused. And then how we expand that sphere of concern beyond self-image, beyond self-construct. And as we move through life, sooner or later, we have direct experience of what the Buddha called the marks of existence, you know, characteristics of existence. And the first one is impermanence, right? Everything in the phenomenal world, without exception, is impermanent, comes into and passes out of existence, subject to change. And then the second mark of existence is, it's what's called non-self, or no self. And what that means is not that there isn't, you know, I'm me and that's Michael, but it means that there's no separate self apart from everything else, that we only come into being and exist within a matrix. I like that word, matrix. Comes from, I think it's related to the word mother, maybe. Of the matrix of non-self elements and beings. We live in that matrix. Matrix is, you know, what they generate cultures of cells in a petri dish, right? It's a matrix of what nurtures, what brings into being. So we simply could not exist without that matrix of all beings. Everything from the microorganisms in our gut to the plankton in the oceans. So much of what our lives depend on aren't even visible, right? To the great earth and the sun that provides the energy that burns in all life. So it's good to stop and remember that also when we're thinking about our sources, our ancestors. And then the third mark of existence is dukkha, most often translated as suffering, but broadly dissatisfaction of every kind. Dukkha is when we don't get what we want, and when we get what we don't want. Happens every day, right? It's happened already today, I'm sure, for each of us in some way. Some little dukkha. I'm trying to remember. What dukkha happened this morning? Oh, no, last night. Our old cat gets a little weird sometimes and gets yowly in the middle of the night. And it's sort of like people who have dementia, they do this thing called sundowning. And our old cat got yowly at 2 a.m. And we both had, and so Michael got up and fed him. And then we had a hard time getting back to sleep. So we're really grateful every night that he doesn't do that. So that's a little bit of everyday dukkha, right? Dukkha is when we can't accept impermanence and when we can't accept non-self. And we don't deeply realize both those truths. And it's when we focus on our desire, when we focus our desires on ourself and on me and mine, what we identify as my family, my country, my career, my language, my best interests, or ours. So we can see the results of that in our world every day as well, and the collective manifestations of dukkha. Bless you. And we lose sight, both individually and collectively, of how our best interests are entirely interconnected with the well-being of our neighbors, of people, plants, animals, ecosystems, and watersheds, even to the well-being of the most difficult people in our lives and in the world. Because if those people were truly happy and truly free, they wouldn't do harm. The great Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh maintains that there's a fourth mark of existence, that it should be configured that, or paired with dukkha, is the absence of suffering, or nirvana, or sukha. Sukha is the sweetness of life, which is also a characteristic of human life, right? It's our birthright, it's our natural condition. Just look at a child totally absorbed in watching an earthworm, you know? Or remember a time that you felt completely whole, nothing missing, fully there. You know, that's a mark of existence too. That's our birthright. Nirvana is not some kind of far distant lotus land, as Hakuin Zenji says in his Song of Zazen. Oh, maybe we should chant that today. Can we quick change it? Hakuin Zenji says, "This very land is the pure lotus land, this very body the Buddha." It's not out there somewhere in the far distant future or far distant land. And sometimes we find that moment of awakening, of vivid, total presence, not just in sublime sunsets out on the beach, but right in the midst of something that we experience as suffering, but then it turns, it opens, it shifts into something more spacious, into the reality of Buddha nature. So last week I mentioned that in early Buddhist thought, women were seen as having less capacity for enlightenment than men, because women were seen to be more prone to attachment, more prone to sensual desire. Or maybe this is just a way of externalizing and blaming women for sexual desire. More attached also to children and family, and unable to take that monastic path of practice. Whole books have been written about patriarchal attitudes towards the female body, so I can't even begin to do justice to that topic today. But I have wondered how women experience impermanence and non-self, suffering and the cessation of suffering, in a direct embodied way. So I don't want to open the can of worms of biological determinism, but I think as women, as men, at any gender, we can observe our own embodied experience. As soon as we make generalizations or blanket statements about gender, we're turning a blind eye to diversity, diversity within any gender, diversity among genders. So let's be clear that there's no template for how we experience living in a woman's body mind. But I have reflected on how having a body whose rhythms are so evident between puberty and menopause, when each cycle brings the possibility of conception and pregnancy and the end of that possibility, how that affects our comprehension of impermanence, like very directly. And of course, there are times when we're just involved in our busy urban lives and not particularly in touch with our biological rhythms, any of us. Light pollution is a major factor. Long ago now, when I was in my early 20s, I lived on a farm. I was an organic farmer in New Brunswick on the Bay of Fundy. And the Bay of Fundy has the greatest tidal difference, highest and lowest, of pretty much anywhere in the world, or among the greatest. And at the edge of our farm was a tidal creek, a tidal marsh creek. So I would see the tides flooding in that creek and flooding out, you know, especially on the most extreme, on the full moon, and then, you know, the king tides of the year. And there was virtually no light pollution at all there. The sky, the starry skies were amazing. And so my own cycles were synchronized with the cycles of the moon. And I would see see the pull of the moon on the waters and feel it in my body most directly. There are times as women when we are trying to get pregnant or trying not to get pregnant when we are keenly aware of this cycle of filling and emptying and the feelings that we have about that. This is impermanence. Most directly. And I've also wondered how women's traditional conditioning to be nurturers and caregivers can constrict or expand our sense of self and non-self. There's a way that caring for others, when done with an open heart and mind, without resentment, opens us to the true nature of connection profoundly. Caring for children, elders, those who are physically or mentally unable to provide for their own needs, caring for animals and plants. These are things that women have done for ages. Caregiving can teach us wisdom and compassion. And men as well as women have the capacity to do the work of caregiving, for sure. Sometimes when we sit at the bedside of someone who's dying, or when we listen to a friend who's in distress, or reach out to pull a child from harm's way, we're just simply there, 100%, responding fully, not conscious of self and other, who is giving, who is receiving. But deep connection, love, and care always carries the risk of loss, inevitably the risk of loss, through death, separation, injury, displacement, and all those experiences of loss become our teacher. I think that there are koans, you know, those teaching stories in the Zen classical canon. I think there are stories of awakening through caring and through loss that are missing from the canon. So many of the classic Chinese koans are about, depict a kind of Zen Dharma combat or one-upmanship, sometimes fierce, sometimes playful, teasing, slapping, and prodding us not to get stuck in the everyday world of life and death, male and female, right and wrong, of duality, and not to get stuck in the absolute perspective of oneness, of non-differentiation either. That's how many of those koans work. I think that stories about awakening through connection, through caring and loss, didn't make it into the canon. But there are exceptions, and there are more stories to be written and told. And some of the exceptions we find in this wonderful collection, The Hidden Lamp, stories from 25 centuries of awakened women, and I shared some last week. Edited by our friends Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon, a great labor of love, great gift to the wider community. So it is part of our life on this earth that as we grow into adulthood and form bonds of love and connection, that we will experience loss. And probably the most devastating loss is the death of a child. Didn't we all feel it just hearing the news from Texas this past week? Unimaginable, and yet it happens. And it doesn't matter how old that child is, even if it's an adult child, the parents, it's still too soon. It's still wrong. The wrong order of things for the parent. So here is a story from the time of the Buddha. Kisa Gotami came from a poor family, but the son of a wealthy family loved her and married her. Her in-laws treated her unkindly because of her background, but when she gave birth to a son, they finally respected her. Then when the child was a toddler, he died, and Kisa Gotami went mad with grief. She carried the dead child from house to house, begging for medicine to make him well, and everyone sent her away, saying, "The child is dead, no medicine can help him." At last, a kind man directed her to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "I will give you medicine to revive your child if you bring me a mustard seed from a house where no one has died." So with renewed hope, Kisa Gotami went forth to find a mustard seed. But at every house, she learned that someone had died. She heard stories of beloved grandparents, parents, and children, even children, who had died from sickness, accident, old age. And so, still carrying her child's body in her arms, she returned to the Buddha. "Did you bring me a mustard seed?" he asked. "I thought that death had happened only to my little son, but now I understand that it happens to everyone. Impermanence is the universal law," she replied. She buried her son in the forest and returned to the Buddha and became a nun and practiced with the Buddha for the rest of her life. When I used to work as a hospice counselor, I led bereavement support groups for all ages, for children, teens, adults, and seniors, all ages. And I would see over time a kind of transformation, even in parents who had lost a child, like Kisa Gotami. Even children would begin to realize, and they'd say something to their friend in the group, oh, you lost your daddy too. Or, oh, your grandma and sister died in the same year? That must have been really hard. They would see and hear each other. Or someone would come to the annual memorial at Christmas time and see so many others writing a loved one's name on an ornament and hanging it on the tree. And they'd come up and say to me, "Oh, I get it now. I see that it's not just my tragedy. It's the way life is. Look at all these other people feeling like I do." So sometimes loss wakes us up. It opens our hearts to the human condition, to others. Not right away, not in the intensity of grieving and missing our loved one, or dealing with the complicated feelings of our relationship to them, if it was a complicated relationship. That requires so much of our energy and attention at first. But a mark of healing is that openness, that awareness beyond the self, and turning toward life and finding a path forward. The question stops being why me, or why her, why him, why my loved one, but how now do I live in the world where this has happened? Sometimes too many losses come at once or too close together, and it is overwhelming. Here's another story about one of the Buddha's women disciples. Her name was Patachara, and in a single day, the story goes, she experienced the death of her entire family. Her husband was bitten by a poisonous snake. Her newborn child was carried off by a hawk. Her older child drowned in a river. And her brother, mother, and father were killed when their house collapsed. Well, maybe that all didn't happen in one day, but maybe it happened close together. And, you know, in a case of a tsunami and an earthquake, people do have massive losses like this. And she lost her mind. She tore off her clothes and wandered naked in circles through the town, through the forest, until she stumbled into a place where the Buddha was teaching. The monks wanted to send her away. They were embarrassed, uncomfortable with her. But the Buddha stopped them and turned to her and said, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." And she did. And she realized she was naked, and a man handed her his cloak, and she covered herself. And she told the Buddha her tragic story and begged him to help her. And the Buddha said, "I can't help you. For countless lives, you have wept for loved ones. Your tears could fill four oceans, but no one can be a secure hiding place from suffering. Nowhere can be a secure hiding place from suffering. Knowing this, a wise person walks the path of awakening." So his words eased her mind, and she became a nun and practiced with the Buddha diligently. And became one of the great women teachers of the time. Recover your presence of mind. Isn't that the crux of our practice, right? You know, we get a little wonky. Recover your presence of mind, which is the healing of our separation of self and world. Right. Isn't that the way in time we come to feel a sense of connection even with the dead? Maybe some of you have experienced that, a sense, suddenly just a feeling of presence, connection with the dead, inexplicably spanning time and space in an instant. But yearning for them, craving for that connection doesn't work. Doesn't bring those moments. Being present and open does, at least in my experience, and others that I've heard. Okay, so those of you who were here last week will remember Satsujo. She was that strong-minded, rebellious teenage student of Hakuin Zenji. And you may remember that Hakuin Zenji, she very keen, very gung-ho in her practice and wanted to ordain, and he actually dissuaded her and said that your path needs to be the everyday life of a lay person. So she had children and grandchildren and became a lay Zen teacher, very well, highly regarded. But one day her granddaughter died. And she was weeping, and an old man from the neighborhood came upon her, and he said, "Why are you carrying on like that? I thought you received a certificate of enlightenment from Zen Master Hakuin." "Idiot," she said, "my tears are a better memorial than 100 priests chanting lugubriously. My tears commemorate every child that has died. That is exactly how I feel at this moment." She's pretty feisty. And the old man just walked off. Yeah. When we do the Tibetan Buddhist practice of Tonglen, we breathe in suffering, the suffering of an individual or the suffering of a world. We breathe in pain and fear, and we breathe out ease and light and healing. And that sounds like a pretty difficult practice to do when we ourselves are in pain. But the way you practice Tonglen with your own suffering is to, as you breathe in, you feel it just as it is, with an awareness of all those everywhere who are feeling that kind of suffering right now. That right now. So if it's the loss of a beloved child, or if it's being raked over the coals by an angry boss, you kind of invoke everybody else who's having that experience, and they're guaranteed there are. You're not the only one in the world who just got raked over the coals by your boss, right? So you include them, and you include yourself. It's a very powerful practice. And you just keep on breathing in that pain and out with healing, kindness, understanding, until you don't know anymore who is the giver and who is the receiver of that practice. And in that way, like Satsujo, you weep the tears of a bodhisattva. When the very worst happens, and it does sometimes, we're not so good at letting go. And we're not even so good at letting go of the more trivial things that go wrong in our lives sometimes. We like to have explanations. We like to have someone to blame. We have would-haves, should-haves, and could-haves, right? Oh, I would, I should-have, I could-have. Or you should-have, you could-have. In the course of a woman's lifetime or any person's lifetime, we have many opportunities to practice with these challenges. Here's another story from a woman in 8th century China whose name has been lost to us. Master Langwei had a woman disciple who came to him for instruction. The master told her to examine the saying, "Let it be." So he kind of gave her a koan. This is your koan. Let it be. He said that if she faithfully used this sentence as a scythe, she would cut down illusions and reap enlightenment. The woman followed his instructions faithfully. One day her house burned down and she said, "Let it be." Another day her son fell into a river and drowned. And when a bystander ran to tell her, she answered, "Let it be." Now, when I read this one, I thought, I'd like a little more information here. I'd like to think that if she were right there by the riverside, she would have jumped in and pulled the little boy out. I don't think "let it be" means to stand there stupidly when there's something that can be done to help. But back to the story. One day, the woman started to make fried cakes, some kind, for dinner, as her husband lit the fire. She prepared the batter and heated the oil and then poured a spoonful of batter into the hot oil. So you can imagine the popping and sizzling sound. When she heard this popping and sizzling sound, she was immediately enlightened. She threw the pan to the ground and jumped up and down, clapping her hands and laughing. Her husband shouted at her, "What are you doing? Have you gone mad?" And she answered, "Let it be." Then she went to her teacher and he confirmed that she was indeed enlightened. Now this one's a little cryptic, I think. We don't know exactly what she experienced at the sound of the batter hitting the oil. But somehow that barrier between self and world dropped away and everything was just as it is. In the canon, there are a lot of stories of awakening happening at a sound. The sound of a stone hitting a bamboo trunk, or a slap from a teacher, or hearing a phrase from the Lotus Sutra. And some of the stories of women's enlightenment are interesting. They have these very mundane elements, like, you know, putting some batter in a frying pan, or trimming a lamp wick before going to bed to put the light out. There's something powerful in being present for the simplest moments of our daily lives. Just the simplest, most unexpected moments. when we give up the struggle and just let it be. Yeah. So, over time, as we mature with practice and insight, maybe we become a little kinder, wiser, a little more patient, and less susceptible to being blown about by the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. We become a little more grounded and stable, like a great mountain. And this is a time when women, often in late middle age, really come into their prime, their full power and confidence. There's a book I've treasured for a long time, published in 1988, called A Wider Giving, Women Writing After a Long Silence. It's a collection of poetry and prose by women in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, who made their major commitment to writing after they were 45. Many of them had raised children or had another, livelihood. And the book's epigraph is from a great poem by the great 20th century American poet, Muriel Rukeyser, from her long poem, Wreath of Women. And it goes, "Women who in my time move toward a wider giving than warm kitchen offering and warm steady living." A wider giving. And I think maybe that's what we all do if we fully engage in growing up. And this quote came to mind as I was preparing this talk, so I had to go look up the poem, the longer poem, and read what comes after it. It goes like this: "Women who in my time move toward a wider giving than warm kitchen offering and warm steady living, no million ignorance or petty village shame, and come to acknowledge the world as a world of common blame. Beyond the men of letters, of business, and of death, they draw a rarer breath, have no career but choice. Choice is their image. They choose the myth they obey." So, when women reach middle age, there's often a strengthened determination to choose the myth you obey, to claim or reclaim those parts that were split off in earlier years, those dreams and aspirations, to offer one's particular gifts to the world, whatever they are. It may be a time when women who've paid their dues in traditionally male-dominated professions, where they finally rise as close to the proverbial glass ceiling as they can, or perhaps rise above it. It doesn't mean that no obstacles remain. And those obstacles that women face as they age, as in youth or in age, are similar but not identical to those faced by others who have been placed outside power structures that limit access, according to race, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, all those different ways, class, religion, ability, all those ways that we separate. And then the intersections between those factors that can cause double or triple jeopardy. Right. I'm reading a memoir from a renowned black woman historian. Her name is Nell Irvin Painter, who gave up her Princeton professorship in her mid-60s and went back to art school. I am so enjoying it. I'm going to talk about it again next week. But to be old, black, and female, she talks about what that was like in art school. Mm. Okay, so this is the last story. It's a story about, in traditional China and Japan, women often made the commitment to Buddhist practice later in life, once their children were grown or maybe they were widowed, and then they could make that choice to practice as nuns. So this is a story from 9th century China about a woman Zen teacher named Moshan Yaoran. And we don't actually know anything about her early life. But we do know that she was the first woman that we know historically to head a Zen monastery and train male monks. And as this story shows, she did encounter some resistance. As you listen to the story, it will help to know that when a Zen master became an abbot, he or she would typically take the name of the mountain where the monastery was located. So when you hear a lot of the names, like with Shan at the end of the name, her name Moshan, Shan means mountain. So Dongshan, Cuishan, it's the name of the Zen master, but also the name of the mountain. Okay, so here's the story. The monk Guangqi had been instructed by his teacher to go and study with Moshan. But upon arriving at the monastery, he refused to bow to her or take off his traveling hat. Quite rude. He asked, "What is Moshan?" Moshan replied, "The summit cannot be seen." "Who is the master of Mount Moshan?" "Without the form of man or woman," she said. And then he yelled at her and said, "Why doesn't she transform herself?" Uh-huh. Remember the reference from last week where a woman has to become a man before gaining enlightenment? So he's ragging on her here. And then she replies, "She is not a wild fox spirit nor a ghost. What would you have her become?" And at that, Guanxi bowed, took off his hat, and he became a gardener at her monastery and trained for 3 years. So wild foxes in Chinese, Japanese tradition are shapeshifters, they're tricksters, like coyote, like ghosts. So she's saying, "I don't need to do any shapeshifting. I don't need to demonstrate superpowers or argue about gender issues." This is your problem. As our practice ripens, we no longer need to transform into any other form than the one we are living right here and now. No need to prove anything to anyone, including ourselves. We can even face the decline of our capacities of body and mind with sickness and old age, with dignity, presence, and our sense of humor intact. My mom couldn't remember if she'd had breakfast 15 minutes ago, but she could still make a wisecrack. She was so funny. So my favorite stories about women and our women ancestors are about old women. And I already sneaked one in to tell you about Satsujo, when her granddaughter died, grieving with the heart of a bodhisattva. So saving the best for last, next week I'm going to tell you some stories about old women. Okay. Present and past. Because I get to be one. And see what dharma they have to offer us. So that's next week. I didn't know this was going to turn into a three-part series, but there's just too many good stories. So thank you all for your attention today. Let's chant.
So page 3 of your chant books again.